Brothers and sisters in the Sangha,
Jai Veen.
So once again, I'd like to say how much I appreciate you're all coming here. It seems this is a particularly difficult time for travelling around in Nagpur. So I very much appreciate the efforts that you've made. And I'm sure that means, that signifies how much you want to follow in Baba Sahib's footsteps. And of course that's what we've been doing over these last 4 days. And today we reach the fifth of our talks, halfway through our series. And we've, as I've said before, covered a lot of ground already. We're learning to follow the path of the Bodhisattva. And we've seen that first of all we need to prepare ourselves. We need to prepare ourselves by developing certain attitudes of mind. And we develop those attitudes of mind by certain practices. We develop that attitude of mind by making offerings. By bowing before the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. By reciting the refuges and precepts. By confessing our faults. Rejoicing in the merits that other people have. Asking for the teachings. And transferring the merits of our spiritual efforts to other people. And last night we ended with that transference of merits. And I know that many of you joined in that, that recitation. And I'm sure that you found this had a very positive effect on your own mind. And that you left this hall in a very different frame of mind. So all of that preparation is done so that the bodhicitta can arise. And that bodhicitta is the mind of the bodhisattva. And it's a mind that has no selfishness at all. That just doesn't see things in terms of me and mine. A mind that just responds to other people. And especially that responds to their sufferings. And it's that mind that Baba Sahib so evidently exemplified. So many of the deeds that we hear of from Baba Sahib exemplify that bodhisattva mind. And with that bodhisattva mind, one undertakes to help all beings. And one makes the four great bodhisattva vows. And those four vows are found right at the end of the Buddha and his Dhamma. And we've been experimenting with just saying those vows at the end of our talks. I pointed out that really they are the expression of the bodhisattva mind. Well, we're bodhisattvas in training. We're not yet full bodhisattvas. But by saying those vows, we prepare ourselves to be full bodhisattvas. And then we saw that once the vow is taken, you practice the 6 or 10 paramitas. And it's the 6 paramitas that we'll be going to look at over this series. So the 6 are Dana, Sila, Kshanti, Virya, Dhyana and Prajna. He got them right tonight. And, well, last night we looked at Dana Paramita. But if you remember, we spent some time just working out what the difference is between Dana and Dana Paramita. And we saw that it's prajna that converts the others into paramitas. Prajna is the first and the chief of the paramitas. Prajna is the first and chief. Actually, we look at it as the last one, but it's really the most important. And we'll be dealing with it in detail in our 9th talk. But for the time being, we need to have some idea of what prajna means. We saw it's the same as vipassana. It's seeing the real nature of things. It's insight into anatta. So it's the destruction of all selfishness. So it's with prajna that the others become paramitas. The other 5 are good qualities, which we all should be trying to develop. But when prajna is there, they become paramitas. So for instance, we saw how this worked with dana. We can all be practicing dana now. Perhaps we're all practicing it now. I'm giving you a talk. You're giving me your ears. So we're giving to each other. Because I'm giving you a talk, I'm bringing your attention to the Dhamma. Because you're paying attention to me, I'm getting inspiration. So this is the situation of dana right now. I'm giving to you, you're giving to me. But it's still at this point just a mundane practice. There's still some idea of self in our minds. But when prajna comes, we go beyond that. That's just completely spontaneous giving without thought of self. Dana plus prajna is dana paramita. We start by practicing dana, and we try to do that more and more selflessly. When we give something, we do go beyond ourselves. We give something that's mine. but then we let it go. So we let go of I. So there's a step towards prajna. And if we do that more and more, eventually the bodhicitta arises. Our mind is quite a different sort of mind. A mind in which dana is completely spontaneous. So dana paramita is what we then practice. So last night I asked you to think about this. I asked you to think about your own practice of dana. I'm sure that you're all practicing dana. I think to somebody brought up in India, dana comes very, very easily. My experience of people in India is that they're very, very generous. But there's always more that can be done. One can always give more. One can always give in a better spirit. So I asked you all to think about that. I asked you to reflect on how you are giving, in what way you could give more effectively. So already we've covered a lot of ground. I've actually given you enough practices to last you this whole life. But there's more to go. We come now to Shila Paramita. For us, Shila is a practice. For the Bodhisattva, is his spontaneous nature. Shila is not something the Bodhisattva has to try to do. But the Bodhisattva can't help but act in accordance with Shila. The Bodhicitta is Shila. So let's examine this closely. What is Shila? Well, it's easiest to start by asking, what is not Shila? Ashila. And sometimes it's easier to understand what something is by looking at what it is not. So what essentially is Ashila? It's causing harm to oneself or other people. It's doing anything that causes anybody, yourself or others, harm. That's harm at the physical level. Harm at the psychological level. So that it makes you unhappy, makes you depressed. Harm at the spiritual level. Anything that prevents you from growing as an individual. Any belief, for instance, that says these people can't develop. Any belief that doesn't say everybody has potential for highest development. It's any teaching that doesn't say that you have the highest potential. So that is Ashila. So Shila is any activity that doesn't harm oneself or other people. It's anything that benefits oneself or other people. That benefits you physically. That benefits you psychologically. So you feel happier, more fulfilled. And benefits you spiritually. So that you're able to develop as an individual. That was the significance of Baba Sahib's conversion. He was asserting that every individual has the potential for Buddhahood. So that's what Shila is. It's whatever helps people to grow and develop as human beings. The Bodhisattva can't help but help. The Bodhisattva doesn't have to think about whether to help or not. He or she automatically, spontaneously, goes to help others. So, well, this is the mind of the Bodhisattva. For Baba Sahib, Shila is vitally important. He says in the Buddha and His Dhamma that morality is Dhamma, Dhamma is morality. In some ways, these are among the most important words in the Buddha and His Dhamma. Shila Dhamma he, Dhamma Shila he. So, and he says that Shila is the direct necessity for man to love man. So Dhamma is Maitri. Shila is Maitri. This is what Baba Sahib teaches. In fact, he goes further. He says, Shila is Bandhutva. Shila Bandhutva hai. Morality is fraternity. And this, of course, is the third great principle underlying Baba Sahib's vision of a just society. You remember that Baba Sahib defines the kingdom of righteousness in terms of liberty, equality, and fraternity. And he says very clearly that he derives these conceptions, these political conceptions, not from the European revolutionaries, but from his master, the Buddha. And he says that a society will be just only when there is fraternity. I think this is one of his greatest insights. Yes, it's very important that there is the structures, the constitution to support a just society. But there needs to be just people. There needs to be fraternity. People who make up society in a loving relationship with each other. That is, within society, everybody needs to have a sense of brotherhood or sisterhood with everybody else. It's not just a question of aple log. It's not just a question of the people who we identify with, who are part of our community or whatever. Baba Sahib saw that India at that time was based upon a system of graded inequality. So that Indians were divided one against the other. And his vision was of an India in which there was brotherhood and sisterhood between every citizen. Caste and community divides and breaks fraternity. So what we see is that brotherhood, sisterhood equals Sheila. If we're practicing Sheila, then we're practicing fraternity. If we're not practicing Sheila, we're not practicing fraternity. And if we are not practicing fraternity, who will? So it's up to us as followers of Baba Sahib to practice fraternity. And we do that by practicing Sheila. And Baba Sahib talked of Sheila as a universal and sacred principle. And it's from the practice of Sheila by the members of society that the kingdom of righteousness comes about. I must say, when I realized what Baba Sahib was talking about here, this is when I really felt I am a disciple of Baba Sahib. I don't know of any other great political leader in the modern era who's seen this connection between a just society and the moral behavior of the individuals. So for Baba Sahib, Dhamma equals Sheila. Sheila equals fraternity. Fraternity equals the kingdom of righteousness. So this is a very, very important paramita indeed. And this is why we must teach Dhamma and encourage people to practice Sheila. By practicing Sheila, we create fraternity. So that we feel we are brothers or sisters to everybody else in society. And the more people who feel like that, the more there will be in India a truly just society. As long as we feel apni log nahi, then we won't have a just society. As long as we keep my Bodhisattva mantra, sarva log apni log ahe, we will have a just society. So that's what practicing Sheila does. That builds the just society. No, there's no other basis. If India is to become a genuinely just society, the Dhamma needs to be available to all. All people need the opportunity to practice Sheila. Otherwise, India will remain just competing castes and communities. If Dhamma is shared by all, morality will be widely followed. And there will be fraternity. We will feel, each of us, that we are brother or sister to everybody else. Of course, it's not just a question of India. We don't have the same problems in my own country. But we have our own problems. There's competing people within community, within society there too. There's a racial problem in our country. There are other problems. So there too, brotherhood, sisterhood needs to be realized. There too, Sheila is needed. There too, Dhamma is needed. And it's the same in every country of the world. There needs to be the worldwide practice of Dhamma. Then there can be Sheila. Then there can be fraternity. Then the world can be a genuinely just world. And we need this really urgently right now. I'm very conscious of this myself, being a British citizen. Quite recently, my own country was at war. You as Indians know that there's tremendous tension on your northern border. The world is a very dangerous place today. It's not just a question of a few soldiers dying. With atomic weapons, millions of people could die. The world could be destroyed. As never before, Baba Sahib's message is needed. As never before, the Dhamma needs to be heard. The Dhamma needs to be heard all over the world. Sheila needs to be practiced the world over. So this is a very, very important point indeed. And it's, in a sense, quite an easy one for us to put into practice. Every one of us can help to create the kingdom of righteousness right now by practicing Sheila. And of course, by practicing Sheila, we begin to experience the mind of the Bodhisattva. If we can really practice Sheila, we will begin to be like the Bodhisattva. The Bodhicitta will arise within us. And we'll act as if every single human being was our brother or our sister. For the Bodhisattva, liberty, equality and fraternity are quite natural. So, that's the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva naturally acts on the basis of Sheila. Sheila is the action of the Bodhisattva. But we have to make an effort. We have to think about it, we have to work at it. If we're honest with ourselves, we know that every day some Ashila is there. So we have to work to transform our actions from Ashila to Sheila. So, what do we have to do? How do we have to make that effort? Well, there's some clue in the Buddha and his Dhamma. You remember that there's that passage where the Buddha and Subhuti are discussing. So Subhuti says, he asks the Buddha, what is the Bodhisattva's perfection of morality? So the Buddha answers, he himself lives under the obligation of the 10 ways of wholesome acting. And he encourages others to do the same. So he lives in accordance with the 10 Kushala Dhammas. And he encourages other people to act in accordance with those Kushala Dhammas. Well, so that's quite simple. It's simple to say, at least. Like so much of the Dhamma, it's very easy to say the words, it's much more difficult to put them into practice. So I want tonight just to talk briefly about the 10 Kushala Dhammas. And say a little bit about how we put them into practice. And then I'm going to say something about how we encourage other people to practice them. I'm not going to be able to go into great detail. But it's probably quite familiar ground for you. And while I'm talking, I'd like you to reflect on your own life in the light of each one. And try and think, well, are you practicing this Kushala Dhamma? In what way could you practice it more? So the 10 Kushala Dhammas combined describe the mind of the Bodhisattva. They describe the behavior of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva naturally acts in accordance with the 10 Kushala Dhammas. Okay, so we're going to look at them one by one. And first of all, the first Kushala Dhamma is Maitri. We act on the basis of Maitri. And you could say that Maitri is Bandhutva. If we feel Maitri, then we act with Bandhutva. So what is Maitri? It's our strong positive feelings of well-wishing towards other beings. We see somebody and we feel, well, I hope that they have everything they want. We hope that they're happy. We hope that they find fulfillment. We hope that they follow the spiritual life. That is Maitri. And it's a very strong warmth in your heart. So when we feel Maitri, we cross the boundary between ourselves and other people. But we obviously love ourselves. We want the best for ourselves. But when we feel Maitri for others, we feel that for them too. So Maitri is a step beyond self. It takes us beyond ourselves. So it's a step towards the bodhicitta. And it leads us to try to help other people and to feel a close bond with them. And this is the bodhisattva's attitude all the time. No matter what people do to the bodhisattva, he or she responds with Maitri. In the Mahayana scriptures, there are many examples of bodhisattvas receiving terrible treatment at the hands of other people. But the bodhisattva still maintains Maitri. This is almost impossible for us to imagine. It means a very deep sense of connection with other people. And that's the direction we need to be going. That is the first Kushala Dhamma. And yes, we need to make great efforts to develop this Kushala Dhamma. So how do we develop Maitri? The first point is that we try not to act with hatred. We try not to act in ways that harm others. In other words, we practice the first precept. Panatipata verimani sikapadam samadhyam. We refrain from harming living beings. That means not causing physical harm to them. Not committing physical violence. Now, there's one aspect of this that I want to share with you. I mentioned yesterday the English people's love of animals. And I personally have felt that if I'm to practice this precept, well then I don't want to kill animals. And many Buddhists throughout the world have felt that therefore the practice of the first precept means not eating animals. This is up to you, of course. Each of us has to decide for ourselves. But it's a very common feeling amongst Buddhists that they don't want to eat animals. Now, the reasons for not eating animals are not ritual purity. It's Maitri. So maybe you could think about that. It's up to you. But that's certainly been my feeling. I remember when I was a small boy, I used to shoot animals. I'm sorry, this is a rather horrible story. I used to shoot them for fun. I didn't really realize what I was doing. But one day I shot an animal and I saw it suffering. I saw it writhing in pain. So I thought, well, I just can't do this anymore. So for me, from then on, I just wanted to not harm animals. And as soon as I could, I became a vegetarian. And that, for me, that was before I encountered the Buddha Dharma. But of course, it's not just a question of not harming animals. We should try our best not to harm human beings. Because we're trying to develop Maitri. So we need to look at our lives and think, what is the violence in our lives? Now we know, of course, it's not a simple matter. Baba Sahib has a quite good discussion of this question in the Buddha and His Dhamma. Unfortunately, sometimes in order to help people, in order to save people, some harm is inescapable. Obviously, if somebody's trying to murder other people, you have to use violence. If somebody's trying to murder people, you have to use violence. No? If somebody is trying to harm other people, you have to use violence to stop them. But the Buddha points out, Baba Sahib points out that this should always be done out of Maitri, not out of hatred. So just, if you can, look at your life and see, is there any way you could practice Maitri more fully? Is there a way you could refrain from harming others more effectively? So that's the first thing to do in practicing Maitri. But then there's something you can do to actually cultivate Maitri. Now, I don't know whether you've experienced this tonight. Well, we've been talking about Maitri. I imagine that you felt some. If you give your attention to Maitri, Maitri begins to grow. Here we all are together. We're listening to the Dhamma. So we have Maitri for each other. We're all united in trying to follow in the footsteps of Baba Sahib. So we can direct Maitri to each other. So when you think about Maitri, when you reflect on Maitri, Maitri grows. Maitri is something you can make to happen. And there are special meditations which help Maitri to grow. There's especially the Maitri Bhavana. And if any of you don't know this practice, we in TBMSG teach it quite regularly, both in Nagpur, in the centre of Nagpur, and at our centre at Nagaloka. And we'll let you know later how you can learn this particular practice. If every day you sit down for half an hour, 20 minutes, and try to develop Maitri, Maitri will grow. And I speak from personal experience. I've personally been doing that practice on and off for many, many years. And I certainly these days find it much, much easier to experience Maitri. So if you want to follow this aspect of Baba Sahib's teaching, then there is this meditation practice. So that's the first of the Kushala Dhammas. And in some ways it's the most important. If you really want to practice one, that's the one to focus on. But there are nine more, so I need to go through them. But I'll go through them rather more briefly. The second Kushala Dhamma is Dana. The Bodhisattva is spontaneously generous. We've already seen this because Dana is also one of the paramitas. So I don't need to say very much about this. First of all, we need to practice Dana by not taking what is not given to us. That is not stealing from other people. Not taking things that they don't want us to have. So this is really worth thinking about. There are many, many ways in which we can take the not given. For instance, sometimes we can take other people's time. You know, they're very busy maybe. Maybe they're very busy. And we stop them. And we ask them questions about this, about that. We don't really want to know the answer. We're just bored, we want to talk. In a way, we've stolen their time. We've wasted their time. So we need to think about that sort of thing. Then of course there's all kinds of corruption. And probably most of us find ourselves involved with this to some extent. And this is quite shocking for coming from the country that I come from. Of course, there is corruption in England too. But not nearly as much as there is here. And I could say that it's one of the things that stops India. If there wasn't corruption, Indian public life would be so much more effective. Now, I know this is a very difficult question, and I'm a foreigner, so I'm not qualified to speak about it. And I know that sometimes it's very difficult to avoid. But really, Buddhists should be examples in India of lack of corruption, non-corruption. And we should do whatever we can to overcome it. I read the other day that in India there is an anti-corruption squad. And I was very pleased when I heard that. But then the person who was talking to me said, well, actually the anti-corruption squad is also corrupt. So we need an anti-corruption squad for the corruption squad. But this is quite serious for Indian public life. It means that Adinadana is right in the center of Indian public life. Adinadana. So I think this is something that Buddhists need to discuss and do what we can to get free of it. One of my friends one of our Dhammacharis is a police inspector. And he said that when he became a Dhammachari, he decided he'd not engage in corruption anymore. And his salary was one third of what it had been before. And of course, first of all, his fellow policemen were very worried about what he might do. But then they became increasingly respectful of him. if we act in a corrupt way, people can't respect us. If we are incorruptible, people will respect us. They may not like it, but they will respect us. So, understanding the great difficulties that you have here in India, I ask you to think carefully about this. I don't live in your society, so it's not for me to say whether any particular individual is right or wrong. But let's try to move India in the direction of a incorrupt public life. That surely is what practicing Adinadana means. And often, of course, corruption means that poor people cannot get the services from the state that they need and deserve. Somebody was telling me the other day that they went to a government office. They just needed a simple form. But it took them some weeks to get that form because they wouldn't give the 1,000 rupees that the officer wanted. But then he looked around the waiting room, and all these people, these poor people, had come in for help. They couldn't afford to pay. So corruption also means inequality. What the state should be providing for everybody is only given to those with money. So it's a very serious question. And if we are trying to practice the second Kushala Dhamma, that is Dana, we should be thinking about this. But practicing Dana doesn't just mean not practicing Adinadana. It means also acting generously. Helping those who are in need, spreading the Dhamma. Anyway, we've talked enough about that. The third Kushala Dhamma is contentment. The Bodhisattva is contented. He feels completely happy wherever he is, whatever he's doing. He doesn't experience constant craving and restlessness. I don't know whether you know that famous story of the encounter between the Buddha and a king. So the king came to the Buddha and said, well, you know, I'm a very powerful Raja. Anything I want, bring. And everybody's just there waiting to serve me. Look at you, you're just sitting out in the forest in your dirty old robe. How can you be happier than me? So the Buddha said to the Raja, okay, let's imagine you just sit down for half an hour and do nothing. How would you feel? So the Raja said, oh, I'd feel fine. I'd be thinking, what can I get my servants to bring me? I could think about conquering the neighboring country. I could think about getting 500 new wives. So I thought, well, I could be completely happy just sitting there. So the Buddha said, okay, how about sitting there for 1 hour? And so the king thought, yeah, well, that's getting it a bit long. Yes, I could think about all these things for a while, but then, yeah, that gets boring. I'd want to go and conquer something or eat something. What about 2 hours? So the king said, well, no, I wouldn't be at all happy then. 3 hours? And the king said, well, no, I'd be very, very bored then. I'd be very restless, very nervous. So the Buddha said, well, I could sit for 1, 2, 3 hours. I could sit all day and be completely happy. I don't need anything. So that's the mind of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva doesn't need anything in order to feel contented. That's a wonderful state of mind to experience. Well, that means that, of course, we need to try to stop ourselves from being restless and from craving. And, of course, traditionally that means not committing sexual misconduct. Being content with our own state, whether we're married or not married. But it means not craving more generally. Not always craving material things. You know, you've got a new motorbike. It's 50cc. But you want a 60cc one. You want a 70cc one. You want a Zen motor car. So you always want more. This is how the whole Western world works. Whatever you've got, you want the newest one, a bigger one. It's all right to have material things. It's all right to satisfy basic needs. But we can just get caught up in the craving of consumerism. And consumerism is growing here in India. When I first came to India, there wasn't anything like that. Well, not experienced by many people. But now in India, well, you're going the way of the West, I'm afraid. Everybody has to have designer clothes. It has to be Nike. But here in India, of course, you can get duplicate Nike. Duplicate. And it's much cheaper than the real thing. But that consumer mentality is coming here in India. And it's working against contentment. Now I want to stress, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a decent life. But we need to be careful not to get caught up in living life for bigger, better material things. So yes, this is contentment. But it's not just a question of not craving. It's learning to be happy with your own mind. And this, of course, is what meditation can teach you. And I might add that also the enjoyment of the arts helps in developing contentment. yes, you can go to loud and noisy Hindi movies. And very exciting and stimulating they can be. But there are also some very, very subtle, very refined Indian films. I've been recently watching some of the films of Satyajit Ray. These were made many years ago, but they're really very, very good indeed. So you end up feeling uplifted and inspired. Again, the same with music. Of course, Hindi film music is very, very popular. And some of it is very good. I begin to recognize sometimes what I hear people singing in the street. This time I haven't worked out what the latest song is. But there's also in India some very much more refined and subtle music. This time in January this year, we had a retreat at Bodharam. And we had some music. It was classical Indian music. And many people said that they learned for the first time that that sort of music can lift you into a meditative state of mind. So I'd suggest that as well as practicing meditation, you tried to listen to or engage with cultural things that lifted you up. Now I'm going to hurry on. Time is moving. The fourth Kushala Dhamma is Satya. The Bodhisattva is always honest. The Bodhisattva doesn't lie. He's honest from the bottom of his heart. So this is very important for us too. And I'd like you to think about it, your own speech. Are you honest? Could you be more honest? If you develop the habit of honesty, well then this will grow. So I've dealt now with four Kushala Dhammas. And of course they correspond to the first four of the five precepts. The remaining six Kushala Dhammas don't correspond to the five precepts. They're refinements of them. They're refinements of them. In our own order, we take precepts that are the expression of those 10 Kushala Dhammas. But so I'm just going to go through these remaining six quite briefly. There are three more connected with speech. We speak so much. We're always talking. And again, this is something I really noticed coming from England. I think, relatively speaking, the English are a rather silent people. Yeah? Yeah. He's been to England, so he knows. They tend to be quite quiet. But Indians are always talking. It's very unusual to see a quiet Indian audience. Well, you really enjoy talking. And that's okay. But it's very easy when your tongue is waggling to break precepts. Sometimes our tongue is waggling, but our brain isn't there. We're just talking, we don't know what we're saying, we don't know why we're saying it. So this is why there are four Kushala Dhammas connected with speech. And the fifth Kushala Dhamma is kindly speech. We shouldn't be engaging in harsh speech. We shouldn't be using swear words, for instance. I fortunately don't know enough Hindi to know any swear words. Fortunately. But sometimes I say, well, what was he saying? And they say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. But really, some of the speech that we use is so unpleasant. It's a bit as if you're being hit on the ear. So we should try to make our speech sweet. Pleasing to other people. And kindly. Something I really notice here is that people very easily get bossy. Yes? You must have a word for it. Bossy. Just saying, do this, do that. Don't do this, don't do that. And often without even looking at it, just don't do that. Bring. And it's quite rude. It's not really treating other people as equals. It's not treating other people as brothers and sisters. Bossism is so common. Bossism. It's a new Hindi word, bossism. Nava Hindi shabda hai. Bossism. So, let's try not to engage in that sort of harsh, cruel, unkind speech. If you want somebody to do something, you can say, well, please, would you mind doing this for me? Or you can say, well, when you do that, I find that very painful. But so you don't have to be harsh. And if you come to our workshop on non-violent communication, you'll learn how not to be harsh. Then sixthly, we have meaningful speech. Our tongues are waggling all the time. Probably, if we're honest, 90% of it is useless. It's quite interesting spending a lot of time in a country where you don't speak the language. These days I know enough Hindi and just enough Marathi to more or less know what people are talking about. And so I know roughly what the topic of conversation is. But I can't join in. And I can't really know precisely what they're saying. So I just sit and watch. 90% of it is rubbish. It's a bit like dogs sort of barking at each other. Woof woof, woof woof. They're not really saying anything at all. So We need to be thoughtful about this. It's the same in England too. It's just that there I can join in, so I get involved in the useless speech. But yes, let's try to make sure that our speech is more meaningful. That it really is a communication. That it's pleasing and helpful to the other person. And maybe we should just practice a bit of silence. Sometimes on our retreats we have a whole week of complete silence. People often find this very, very difficult indeed. But if you do keep silence for quite a long time, you find you get a lot of energy. So maybe more silence, less useless speech. Then we have seventhly, harmonious speech. Speech that brings people together. Speech that creates harmony, that creates bandhutva. What do we talk about a lot of the time? We talk about other people. So Kumarajiva and I are sitting here and we're talking about that person over there. And we're not saying what a good man he is and how well he's done. We're saying how useless he is, how bad he is. And we're agreeing with each other that he's a bad man. And we're telling stories about him. And of course the stories are often completely untrue. But the effect is to create disharmony. And I found that there's something that people are very good at. Spreading rumours. And people will spread rumours about anything. You know, did you know that Subhuti got married yesterday? Sooner or later, everybody knows that Subhuti's got married. Not only that he got married, he's got three wives. And it's completely untrue. I've got no intention of getting married. But this is the way things go. Now please don't go away and say that Subhuti said he's got three wives. But rumours go about. We love spreading rumours. And rumours create disharmony. So we should try not to spread rumours. We shouldn't create factions. If we say something, it should be something that creates harmony. And this is probably something that we all need to do a great deal more work on. One of our favourite activities is gossip. Men always say that women are very good at gossiping. But women know that men are even better. You see? They're all laughing. So we should try to stop gossip. Actually, men and women are equally bad at it. I don't want to create disharmony between men and women. So we should try to speak harmoniously in a way that brings people together. And you hear so much speech in India, especially in the political arena, that's unharmonious.
Bhang karne wali hoti hai, visavad nirman karne wali.
So as Buddhists, let's try to spread harmony through our speech. Let's be friends to all. Now there are three Kushala Dhammas left, and I'm going to just mention these. There's the Kushala Dhamma of tranquility. That's non-craving. Then there's the Kushala Dhamma of compassion. That's non-hatred. So these are. This is not just dealing with our behaviour, it's dealing with what goes on in our minds. It's getting rid of unskillful states in our own minds. And this implies meditation. If we practice meditation, we will get rid of hatred and greed and develop tranquility and compassion. If we do meditation. We will get rid of hatred and craving. And we'll replace them with tranquility and compassion. But we're going to deal with this much more under Dhyana Paramita. And then finally, the 10th Kushala Dhamma is Prajna. Well, that we're going to say much more about that later. So there's a lot for you to think about. A lot for you to practice. And I do ask you all to think very seriously about practicing the precepts and these Kushala Dhammas much more fully in your life. And I suggest again that you think about confession. If you can, it's quite good to have a little group of friends who you get together with regularly. Maybe four or five of you just come together once a week and you think about the precepts. And if you feel you've broken a precept, well, you say, I'm very sorry indeed, I was not able to keep that precept. It happened because of these reasons. In future, I will try not to act in that way again. And in that way, you will develop the Kushala Dhammas. This is what Baba Sahib says is the case for the bhikshus. The practice of confession helps them to keep the bhikshu rules. So why shouldn't lay people engage in that practice too? We're just as committed as bhikshus. We can practice the Dhamma just as fully as bhikshus. So why shouldn't we use that practice of confession? Of course, if you do practice confession with each other, you must be careful to keep confidentiality. You shouldn't immediately go from confession and say, oh, that person there, they did this. So, let me just deal with one more point. Baba Sahib says practicing Shila Paramita is putting the 10 Kushala Dhammas into your life. And then he says it's also encouraging others to practice the Kushala Dhammas. How do you get others to practice the Kushala Dhammas? Well, one very important point is how you don't encourage them to do so. You won't help people if you have a very blaming and bullying attitude to them. If you say to them, "You're a very bad man, you use that harsh speech." When you're doing that, you're actually using harsh speech yourself. And they won't stop using harsh speech. They'll just get angry back at you. You don't get people to practice Shila by bullying. You don't get them to practice Shila by blaming them. People don't act unskillfully because they want to be bad. It's because they don't know what else to do in that situation. What they need is your help and your understanding. They need your sympathy. Your help in understanding what it is that they need. That sort of judging, blaming attitude doesn't help. The main thing that encourages other people to practice the Kushala Dhammas is seeing you practice them. If they see that you're leading a good life and that you're a happy person, they'll want to be like you. That's the main way in which you encourage others. But you can encourage others by befriending them. Understanding them. Showing them how Kushala Dhammas will help them. Encouraging them to act skillfully. Supporting them in trying to act skillfully. For instance, by confessing with them. So if you do all of this, people will practice the Shila too. If you bully them, if you shout at them, if you blame them, they'll just act badly even more. Or they'll act well only out of fear. So this is a very, very important point indeed. But if we act in that encouraging way, exemplifying Shila, others will follow us. And then fraternity will flourish. And the kingdom of righteousness will come into being. And as a result of that, the bodhicitta will arise in our own minds. And we will be fulfilling Baba Saheb's very strong aspiration for us. And we'll be following very much in his footsteps. So I'd like to stop now, to finish now, in the way that we did last night. Just reminding ourselves of those vows that Baba Saheb places at the end of the Buddha and his Dhamma. And then transferring the merits that we've gained from this evening to all beings. So I invite you, if you want to recite these after Kumarajeev. There are beings without limit. I vow to convey them all across.
इस संसार में प्राणी असंख्य हैं। मैं प्रतिज्ञा करता हूँ उन सबको भवपार करने की।
There are kleshas in us without number. I vow to extinguish them all.
मेरे अंदर दोष असंख्य हैं।
मेरे अंदर दोष असंख्य
हैं। मैं प्रतिज्ञा करता हूँ उन सबको नष्ट करने की।
There are truths without end. I vow to comprehend them all.
Satya anant.
मैं प्रतिज्ञा करता
हूँ उन सबको समझने की।
There is the way of the Buddha without comparison. I vow to accomplish it perfectly.
बुद्ध के मार्ग अतुलनीय हैं। मैं प्रतिज्ञा करता
हूँ
उन सबको प्राप्त करने की।
एवं सब करके मैंने जो पुण्यार्जन किया है उसे सब प्राणियों का सर्वदुख शमन करी बनूं। जैसे पृथ्वी आदि महाभूत अनंत आकाश पर्यंत व्याप्त अनगिमत प्राणियों के नाना प्रकार से भोगी होते हैं, वैसे ही आकाश व्याप्त प्राणियों के लिए मैं तब तक नाना प्रकार से उपजीव्य हूँ जब तक कि सब शांति का लाभ न खा ले।